You are listening to 97.3 LP FM, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on Open Source RVA, we speak with Mo Karn and John Q. Public about the recent injunctions served to Mo and others by the Richmond Police Department. We talk with Christopher Maxwell, who's involved with the new international hostel opening in downtown Richmond. We also present part two of our interview with Gigi Armitage, the author of Come August, Come Freedom. But first, here are the top stories making headlines right now. When Black Friday falls, you know it's got to be.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Richmond City saw its 38th homicide of the year on Monday morning. Officers called to the scene of a car accident found Terrell Anderson, 33, shot to death in a vehicle on the 3900 block of Larchmont Lane, which is in the 2nd Precinct. An arrest has been made in the case, which, as the 38th slaying in the metro area so far in 2012, brings us almost to 2011's total of 39, according to Richmond Police Department data. As details of Mayor Dwight Jones's deal to bring the Redskins training camp to Richmond continue to become public, members of the incoming Richmond School Board have weighed in on the subject. On Tuesday, administration officials, along with officials from both Bon Secours and the Redskins, made their pitches during two often tension-filled back-to-back public hearings. The first, a special city council meeting originally slated to begin at 4 p.m., was rescheduled on short notice Tuesday morning to begin 1 hour earlier. Open Source RVA spoke with school board member-elect Jeff Bourne outside city council chambers that afternoon. Bourne, who currently serves as a deputy chief of staff to Mayor Jones, indicated his overall support for the deal. "I think from an economic development perspective, it's a great win for the city," Bourne said, attesting that the more details he learns, the more he's pleased with what he believes the project will bring to the city and its schools. But Glenn Sturdivant, another recently elected board member, was cooler on the subject during the second public meeting held at Bon Secours St. Mary's Hospital. Speaking during a public comment period, Sturdivant clarified his concerns were not with the overall effort to bring the Redskins to Richmond, but with what he identified as a lack of transparency in the process. Additionally, Sturdivant questioned whether the city's plan to lease the old West Hampton School building at Libby and Patterson Avenues to Bon Secours for the low price of $5,000 per year for 60 years, circumvented a 2008 city ordinance requiring proceeds from sales of former schools' facilities to go back to Richmond Public Schools. City administration officials defended the terms of that lease as necessary to securing the nonprofit hospital's support in helping fund about $6.4 million of the cost to develop the training facility to be located behind the Science Museum on Lee Street. Meanwhile, Bourne, speaking to Open Source during the earlier meeting, acknowledged the lease deal might not be true to the spirit of the ordinance, but proposed that the effort should be on working with city officials to clarify the ordinance for the future. Bourne declined to criticize the West Hampton lease deal, rather suggesting that instead of nixing that deal, he'd like to see the Redskins and Bon Secours agree to help fund improvements to school athletic fields. Senator Mark Warner says he will not run for governor in 2013. Reporter Mike McKenzie has more.
The former governor released a video on his YouTube channel this week announcing that he'll sit out next year's race to focus on his role in the U.S. Senate. The Democrat has built a reputation as a centrist since his 2008 election to national office. He says he wants to find common ground with Republicans.
"But even if we avoid the fiscal cliff, we still have so much more important work to do right here in Washington. Immigration reform, improvements to education. We still need a 21st century energy plan. And boy, oh boy, we still have a lot more work to do to strengthen the economic recovery. And all of these issues will also require tough choices."
Warner is also co-sponsor of the Fast Voting Act, a competitive grant program that would encourage states to make voting easier through early voting and assistance for non-English speakers and people with disabilities. He served as governor of Virginia from 2002 to 2006. Warner's announcement narrows the list of potential candidates for the 2013 Democratic ticket. The former DNC chairman Terry McAuliffe is the only candidate to have officially announced his intention to run. Virginia political blogs have speculated that former 5th District Congressional Representative Tom Perriello may also run. Perriello is the current president of the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning D.C. think tank. The Republican ticket will be decided in a closed convention next year. The party voted in June to reverse its 2011 decision to hold an open primary. Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling was in line for the Republican nomination after skipping the 2009 gubernatorial race in favor of a second term as lieutenant governor. But the entry of Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli into the race has thrown the state Republican Party's traditional line of succession into disarray. Bowling is running with endorsements from Governor Bob McDonnell and recently reelected House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, but the closed convention format may favor Cuccinelli, who's highly regarded among the party's more conservative base. In a recent email to supporters, Cuccinelli cited the Constitution and Martin Luther King Jr. as inspirations for his candidacy. The Attorney General says he'll push to limit the role of government and increase individual liberties. Cuccinelli's attracted national attention during his tenure as Attorney General for his challenges of the Affordable Care Act and federal immigration actions, LGBT protections at state schools, and climate research at state-funded universities. For Open Source RVA, I'm Mike McKenzie in Richmond.
If you're driving across Virginia's highways this holiday weekend, be on the alert that Virginia State Police will be employing all available troopers until midnight Sunday. According to a report in the Lynchburg News and Advance, the increased police presence is a response to a huge increase in highway deaths and injuries along Virginia's highways during the Thanksgiving weekend last year. The new police initiative, Operation CARE, which stands for Combined Accident Reduction Effort, is particularly targeted at compliance with Virginia's move-over law, which mandates that motorists move to the farthest lane when emergency vehicles are stopped on the side of the road. Last year, during the Thanksgiving holiday season, highway patrolmen ticketed more than 9,000 speeders, 3,082 reckless drivers, 741 seatbelt violators, and 263 child seatbelt violators. Approximately 130 tickets for drunk driving were also given out. The 35th annual Model Railroad Show choo-choos down the track at the Science Museum this weekend. This yearly event, which starts today and continues through Sunday, kids of all ages are encouraged to design their own model train layouts, to wear train cars, hear folk songs about riding the rails, and get the lowdown on steam engines. There will also be a brand new IMAX film about trains, and blacksmith Gerald Biggs will come hammer in hand to show how he makes art and functional items out of railroad spikes. But of course, the main attractions will be the hundreds of cool model trains on display. Information on tickets and a complete lineup of events for the Model Railroad Show can be had at smv.org.
In the winter of 2010, Mo Karn, a member of the Richmond Wingnut Anarchist Collective, filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Richmond Police Department for the department's general orders and protocols, an extension of the collective's Cop Watch program that seeks to ensure police accountability. Shortly thereafter, Karn became, if she already was not, very unpopular with Richmond police officials. Interestingly, at the time, RPD provided her only with half of what she'd asked for. A brief and very public spat, including an injunction claiming she couldn't have the documents because of her anarchist views and support from the Virginia ACLU that silenced the police protests, had Karn keeping the general orders online at the Wingnut's website. Since then, Karn has continued requesting the rest of the general orders, but those requests have been ignored. That is to say, the Richmond Police Department has not responded to a citizen's request for information until last week, sort of. Mo Karn is with me today, along with John Q. Public, who is going by an alias today. John is where the documents came from, and we'll get into that in a second. Welcome, guys.
Good evening.
Hey, nice to be here.
Thank you. Can you tell me a little bit about, I guess, maybe start with you, John.
Sure.
Where did these documents come from?
Well, I just happened to come across them in a random and lucky way. Literally just found the digital documents on a USB storage drive. And didn't know what was on it when I found it initially, took it home, and to my surprise and elation, it was filled with internal Richmond Police Department documents ranging from general orders to evaluations to financial requests and other information.
Where did you find it? It was
just
on the sidewalk?
I'm not going to say specifically, but literally, yeah, on the street, basically, near a trash can. So it was clearly discarded or misplaced. But one can only assume, you know, the data wasn't that important to the person carrying it if it was, you know, tossed aside in such a way.
Now, really, the reason that you guys are here today is since then, you've put these documents up, and they were up for about 2 days, and then they pretty quickly came down. You put them up on November 14th, and they were down by the 16th after yet another injunction filed by RPD.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about what happened there with this injunction?
Well, basically, when John came to me knowing about the previous FOIA case with the information, did a brief write-up and linked to the documents from the Wingnuts website and, you know, started promoting it to let people know that they were out there and now they could look at these protocols and everything to see what rules the police are supposed to be following. And we got a lot of hits on the website and it seemed like a lot of people were interested in getting the rest of the information that we hadn't been able to provide before. And then I was at work on Friday, and I started getting texts from my roommate saying that the police were coming to the house serving me papers. I was like, okay, I'll just read it when I get home. And later in the day, hey, the police came again. They served more papers. Then my mom called me. Hey, the police came to my house. She lives in Hanover County to serve papers. And then later when I got off work, a friend called, hey, the police came by my house looking for you to serve you papers. So I finally got home and found the injunction, which was very broad, very general, basically saying I could assume what they were talking about, but it didn't really specifically say which files in particular they were worried about. It just made it seem like they were against all of the files being out there, even though their reason was that they were worried about, they say that some of the files had personal police document or personal police information about individual officers that they didn't want to be public. And then they also served that injunction to the website that had been hosting them. And I think that that website got scared and took them down.
And that was, where were you using? This was a larger web hosting site?
Filebin.net.
Okay.
I don't know much about it at all.
Pastebin is the more commonly known branch of it. It's just used for posting like bits of code or text, any text data. And by the way, these injunctions are available online for anyone who wants to look at virginiacopblock.org and wingnetrva.org. Yeah.
They were pretty expansive in their approach to shut this down. So obviously they had
very broad
language.
Problems.
And they went lots of places. They went to Nathan Cox, who's with Virginia Cop Block. They went to his work, his mom's house, his house. And it wasn't your normal case where you just get a process server person from the court delivering you the injunction. And each place there were 3 to 4 police officers.
Yeah,
my house, there was a federal marshal in a black SUV with tinted windows who came with the police. At my friend's house, there was a Richmond police officer in full tactical gear who swore up and down I wasn't in trouble. And then my friend was like, well, then why are you in full tactical gear?
Yeah, it's really hard to think of a reasonable explanation as to why they would need that kind of manpower to serve some papers unless you look at, you know, the possibility that they're just trying to intimidate the people they're serving into cooperating with their unconstitutional orders.
Now, what you posted did, from what you were telling me, include some information on some broader investigative operations ongoing and budgetary stuff. We won't get into that just to make sure that
I don't believe that was actually posted yet. It was just the general orders that were posted, which is basically just internal police policy, how they're supposed to conduct themselves, you know.
Which would be technically what you had FOIA'd in the first place.
That's exactly right.
And I mean, honestly, I didn't read the documents before they were online and I linked to them. It's over, well over 1,000, I would say, documents because it's general orders and then archive versions going back like a decade of the general orders, you know, previous drafts and all that kind of information. And I've got a job. I didn't have time to look at that. I just put it online because I figured the public deserved to see it.
Yeah, that's part of the reason we wanted to get it out there because, you know, many hands make light work and we wanted to get as many people as possible. Start sort of sifting through the information to find anything that could be useful or helpful.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your initial effort. When you first went after these documents, why was it that you wanted to put them back on or to make them public?
The reason we originally decided that we should start trying to FOIA police protocols and general orders was because when we were doing Cop Watch and observing and recording the police, we realized that if we didn't know what the police's own rules and regulations were, we wouldn't be able to spot it when they were breaking those rules and regulations. And so in order to effectively hold them accountable, we needed to know what they were supposed to be accountable to.
And now Cop Watch, for those not familiar with it, you guys go out, you've usually got video cameras and you will tape them while they're in operation around the city. I know I've seen you guys in operation a couple of times.
The idea isn't to interfere. We just sort of hold them accountable and put the camera on them so that they know that everything they're doing is going to be public information if they decide that they want to violate someone's rights or overstep their authority.
And this is a repetition of something that is done in other cities. It's not a...
All over the world, yeah.
And in fact, some of these videos have had serious consequences for some police where they've done things that were not good.
Yeah, well, when it's, you know, the police words against the citizens, the tendency is to side with the police, and yeah, abuse of, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. There's just always going to be some abuse of power, and the police aren't really willing to police themselves, and so it really comes down to civilians or citizens taking it into their own hands.
So how did the general orders that you were able to get hold of, the half of them that you were able to get hold of, how did that affect your ability to patrol?
I mean, a lot of the information in there is frankly quite boring, which is why it was really funny that they were so upset about it being public, because they've got information about the rules for bicycle cops and Segway cops and, you know, just kind of this mundane, silly stuff about, you know, you're not allowed to have a passenger on your Segway or you're not allowed to smoke
look
a cigarette
goofy on
while
your
Segway.
You're, oh, wait,
you know,
you
in
not.
Uniform and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But it hasn't all... I haven't had an instance where it's been super vital to have known that.
There hasn't been much time passed. You know, some of the stuff's relevant, like, you know, how they're supposed to handle checkpoints on the highway or conduct themselves during mass arrests. And there's actually a section about the Constitution and how you should, you know, respect the citizens' constitutional rights when you're dealing with them in any way. So a lot of it is pretty relevant. It just takes a little bit of work to sift through it and get at what is useful.
And things like that. I mean, RPD is there for us at the end of the day.
They're public servants. We pay their salaries, and so I think we're entitled to know how they conduct themselves and what they're supposed to be doing.
But again, coming into, I guess, law enforcement, I'm sure many and all of them probably have the best intentions. Power can be a difficult thing to deal with, and that's why you have general orders. So
right.
They understand what their boundaries are.
I would add that outside of Cop Watch, I've had – I'd say at least 5 lawyers that I didn't know but who I saw in court buildings over the past year and a half or whatever it's been tell me that they go on our website and they've downloaded the general orders because lawyers could have always had access to them, but they didn't always think to look for these documents.
Sure.
Because sometimes FOIA is really difficult to figure out. You have to name what you're looking for, and that can be hard. And so lawyers throughout Richmond now have access to this, and they're better able to defend their clients because they can find those really
That's
picky situations where the police have maybe overstepped something, and it helps defend the public the way they should be defended.
So where do things stand right now? You have an injunction still in force against you, Mo.
Yeah. Nathan Cox and I still have an injunction against us.
Nathan is?
Nathan Cox, he's with Virginia Cop Block, and he was the other person who posted link to the documents on his website.
Yeah.
And we both have attorney Tom Roberts and his whole law office. They took on our case, and they are trying to file counter documents this week, starting today. To fight the injunction on the grounds that it's overly broad and unconstitutional.
Starting today, Thursday or Wednesday, I guess. What is today?
Today's Monday.
Today is Monday. Okay. This will be broadcasting on Friday.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, today is the 19th.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's filing these on the 19th in hopes to free this stuff up again.
Mm-hmm.
You've been forced to get rid of the information that you had, or
– The injunction says that I have to I think it says that I have to return the information to the courts and stop disseminating it. But I have no idea what that means in terms of how – what that process even looks like. And it's very difficult legal language to understand.
Especially when they're so unspecific with what they – you know, obviously the stuff about segues is not what they're concerned with, you know.
Have they come looking to follow through on this injunction, seeking the information that you have?
They have not. I have not actually personally seen any of the police who were coming and trying to serve me papers or intimidate me. So they haven't taken the information. I mean, the information's been on – it was online for 2 days. Over 3,000 people looked at our website.
Now.
And lots of people have downloaded it at this point all over the world. So – you know, even if they tried to come and take it away from me as an individual, that wouldn't stop this information from being public.
Yeah, physical copies have also been distributed to key people who, you know, I'm not going to name, but, you know, they're going to spread it to people they know and just get it to any news outlet or whatever they can. It's the cat's out of the bag at this point, and it's not going to go back in there. So they need to just accept that they're going to be held accountable for, you know, what they're doing. And the information should have been public in the first place, so...
All right. And in fact, again, they had released that information to you or half of it previously.
They had released the general order stuff, the other things that were on that USB, including like narcotics reports and the evaluations of officers and a whole bunch of pictures of the when they busted up the Occupy Richmond Kanawha Plaza encampment were on there, too.
Yeah,
so that stuff wasn't public already. But
yeah.
OK. And at this point, no intention of publishing that as yet.
Well, I personally cannot publish anything that might fall under that injunction just because I don't want to give them any ground to stand on. But other people who weren't named in that injunction have access to that data as well because more than one person was given it originally. So I would expect that a lot of that information is going to appear online in the next few days.
And you can give an injunction to one singular website, but there are a lot of websites that are going to host the information. And, you know, good luck getting all of it down.
All right. Well, guys, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Again, Mr. Roberts will be filing whatever his answer is to this in the next couple of days.
Yeah, hopefully.
And maybe we'll have an update sometime next week or maybe this week before this report runs.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Thank you again. Again, Mo Karn and John Q. Public.
Yes, and if I could just put out an email for anyone who wants to get a hold of me, it's richmondpdinfo@gmail.com if you'd like to get your hands on the information.
And we'd also like anybody who has police files, any of different Richmond Police Department documents, is free to contact the Wingnut Anarchist Collective to give us those files as well.
Yeah, any tips are appreciated.
All right. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Open Source RVA contacted the Richmond Police Department to ask about the injunction, as well as the department's failure to respond to Mo Karn's repeated FOIA requests. Gene Lepley, a spokesman for the department, declined comment on the injunction, saying only that everything's sealed. Lepley indicated he had received no information requests from Karn and referred further inquiries to the department's lawyer. Efforts to reach a lawyer were not successful prior to this broadcast.
Broadcast of WRAR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu.
I'm a traveling man, made a lot of stops all over the world, and in every port I own a heart, at least one lovely girl.
Founded in 1934, the International Youth Hostel Organization has provided home away from home for generations of worldwide travelers on a budget. Those travelers, though, have had to give Richmond a pass. Hosteling International Richmond, the new name of the organization, recently broke ground, or more aptly, repointed mortar on a building at 7 North 2nd Street last Sunday. The historic building, built in the 1920s as headquarters of the Otis Elevator Company and later used as a women's prison, will reopen within the next 2 years as a place for weary and penny-pinching travelers. I'm here with Chris Maxwell, who is an owner's representative with the Potomac Area Council of the Youth Hostel Organization, which has a very long name we won't go into. Welcome, Chris. How are you doing?
Thank you. Yes. Glad to share with Richmond this exciting chance for the world to come to us. You know, we all love travel. You know, almost all my friends have gone traveling in some form or other. And now we'll have the chance to actually meet people from all over the world to come here and visit us. And we have so much to offer them. And one of the things that we're planning to do that's a little extra twist than the other hostels is that we'll have a studio built into this one.
A music studio.
Well, it's a studio for sound. So it could be spoken word. It could be storytelling. It could be music.
Interesting.
And so we'll have, let's say, like a loaner closet full of instruments. And then we'll have a listserv with Richmonders who would want to share in the experience of jamming with people from all over the world who may tell us in enough advance. You know, we'll ask them to tell us in advance 3 or 4 days if they're coming and they want to do this. And then, you know, just let that interaction happen. And, you know, every once in a while you'll just have this amazing interaction of spoken word, poetry, and music from people from China,
sounds
New
really,
Zealand,
really exciting.
Australia, Brazil, wherever they're coming from.
Now, we just kind of hopped right into this, but the idea of the youth hostel is, of course, again, it's this long-standing idea of providing a welcoming place in a community for a traveler who's not necessarily of a budget. It's been long sort of the mainstay of the college traveler, the young person who's kind of
backpacking. Well, it's a very good reason that it's for college, actually, is because this is much more than just about saving money, which you can do by, you know, putting up a tent and you know, in some nasty little corner of an alley or something. But the purpose of a hostel is not just to save money. It's to have the opportunity to network and meet with other people. And that's why I thought it's not just about a cheap bed. It's about education. About the education of actually going someplace and seeing for yourself what it's really like. For me, for example, I went to Moscow in 2003 and was amazed when, at that time, we did not have smartphones except for one Kyocera 700 for the geekheads. And it was a crappy phone, mono screen, you know. And this guy, a janitor on the train, had this amazing full-color smartphone, and he was surfing the internet in Russia. And he was a janitor working his way through mineral school.
Wow.
And I came back from that experience saying, what else have they told me in America, land of the free and opportunity, that's not really true about Russia and other places?
So it really is experiencing other cultures, being a part of other cultures, not just passing through them.
That's why I wanted to do the radio, the audio studio there, so that we could create that interaction and record it, and then we can put it on WRAR, the internet, maybe other radio stations.
Explain the general concept of a hostel. You stay for a set period of time,
each hostel's different. They set their policy different depending on the context of the culture and the city and whatnot that they're in. Generally, there is a geographic limit. You can't stay in the hostel if your residence is less than, say, 50 or 20. And again, each hostel is different. Ours is 50 miles because the city doesn't want it to become a homeless shelter.
Sure.
And its purpose is education and sharing with cultures. So I don't mean that to come off anti-homeless. I apologize if it does. But the purpose of it is to bring people from all over the world through Richmond. And so that's one of the ways that they do that. But also it reassures the city because they, of course, can reject your special use permit, which is, you know, everything interesting. And Richmond ends up in a special use permit process.
Very
as
true.
As did WRAR.
Very true.
So if you're planning anything really cool, just plan on the special use permit.
SUP. That's the only three initials you
happen.
Need.
Yeah. So its purpose is education and sharing across cultures. And so
is there a limit to the length of time somebody
stays?
Yes,
there is usually a limit to the length of time. We're still kind of bandying that back and forth. I think at this point the thought is like 3 weeks or a month at the most. And some of them are 3 days and some of them are 3 months.
A good period of time, though, to come into a community.
Oh, plenty of time, yeah.
To get to know some people, to learn a little bit about what life in Richmond or Moscow might be like.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm hoping what's going to happen is people from all over the world are going to come through here in the learning stage of their life where maybe they don't have a lot of money, but they do have a lot of inspiration. And then they're going to go back to wherever, and they're going to make money and connections, and they're going to become whoever it is they want to become. They may then call back or email the people they met in Richmond and connect Richmond to the whole world through those personal one-on-one connections that they're going to make here with the people that are listening to this show right now, or maybe friends of those friends. And thereby, Richmond becomes much more cosmopolitan and yet still affordable, really nice place to live. You know, people from all over the world get to see some of the really awesome buildings, and the river is incredible. Thanks very much to Ralph White. He has kept that river.
Little plug for our director of parks, will be retiring this year.
Yes, but you know, good people deserve good plugs. And what he's done to preserve a really wonderful park is definitely going to be something I point people to when they come to visit the hostel.
Well, hopefully some of your friends from Moscow come here and
exactly
see what's to be seen in Richmond.
Right, and some of them may choose to move to Richmond because of these great experiences. So we may become more cosmopolitan that way as well.
Now, tell me, you had some dates that are upcoming that have to do
absolutely
with...
Absolutely. One of the things we love to do is start off right away sharing experiences. We have something called the Vicarious Traveler Series that we're currently holding at the main library of the City of Richmond, City of Richmond Main Library, Vicarious Traveler Series. And so this next batch starts on January 5th with the Frugal Australian, and that's Emily, about her travels in Australia as a work-study student over there. Budget Travel on the 19th. On February 9th, it's going to be Cambodia.
Hmm.
And then on March 16th, we're going to have a panel of three people about woofing. That's...
Woofing.
World Organization of Organic Farming.
Hmm.
And that's where people go to countries all over the world, including the United States, and they volunteer, or sometimes they get paid a stipend to work on an organic farm, learn.
And this has actually become very popular as sort of a package tour kind of thing.
Yes.
I've read about these in higher-end vacation magazines.
Right.
I'm going to pay money to go and work on a farm in Italy or someplace.
Yeah, because
like
you not only get to learn something about the way they're doing organic and hopefully sustainable farming, but also that culture's implementation of their food. And I mean, you know, what better food than a native Italian cooking native Italian food on an organic farm where you just
straight out
that
of where
food
you pulled
like
it
20 minutes earlier.
Wow.
You know, that's got to be the best gastronomic experience possible.
And frankly, Richmond is becoming much more of a food town.
Yes.
And we definitely have some very regional foods, and so you could see where this would be possibly.
Exactly. We have so many restaurants here, and we've got awesome microbreweries that people can come to visit for.
Absolutely.
You know? So Richmond has so much to offer, and we hope to be that place, that portal that they can afford to come and visit it when they're not that wealthy. And then later on, they'll develop their connections and become who they want.
I had a former editor who used to always say that we needed to change our slogan to Richmond, a tropical city, in order to try and draw tourists here. But maybe just Richmond, a cosmopolitan city,
might be
where we're heading.
We have a lot of amazing stuff to share.
Thank you very much. Speaking of sharing, thanks, Chris Maxwell, who is the
owner's representative
for...
Come and see the construction in action, 7 North 2nd Street. We're making a special effort to make sure that the mortar and the bricks and everything we do with the windows honors the building's history.
I'm sure it's going to be beautiful.
Oh,
you're keeping the windows true to
as
the...
As much as we can. Some of them are pretty abused.
I mean, sure.
It was a woman's prison, and some of those women were pretty strong, actually. So the windows are a little rough in some places.
All right. And are you taking volunteers to help to do some of the construction?
So yes,
come out not just
definitely
to watch, but to participate.
Well, we're not quite ready for volunteers this week.
Okay.
And also it's Thanksgiving week. But if you're interested in historic reconstruction and the hostel, we will definitely be needing help with a lot of the aspects of building an actual amazing historic building.
Right. And do you guys have a website yet, or is there a
Facebook? We have a
Facebook
page. We also have a WordPress page, and we have if you just Google Richmond Hostel, it takes you right to the WordPress and the Facebook page.
Hop right up, okay.
Yeah.
Again, thanks, Chris. It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
All right.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, 804-771-5715 or www.kaufmanandknowles.com.
Does anyone know the name Gabriel Prosser?
Gabriel's insurrection was no simple spur-of-the-moment uprising. The attempted rebellion in August of 1800 had its philosophical roots in the same Enlightenment ideals that lit the fires of the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Haitian Revolution. Gabriel was born on a Henrico farm belonging to Thomas Prosser, a friend and business partner of Patrick Henry. The slave's own rallying cry of death or liberty was backed by a well-organized battle plan of his own devising that would, had weather not intervened, have sought to take Richmond, capture Governor James Monroe, and entreat him to free all Virginia slaves. Gabriel's life and upbringing are the subject of a new book by Richmond author Gigi Amato, Come August, Come Freedom, The Bellows, the Gallows, and the Black General Gabriel. The question is how important should Gabriel become in telling the story of Richmond, in telling the story of liberty and freedom and our country?
Gosh, that is the question. And, you know, I think he's incredibly important to not only to Richmond, not just to Richmond or to our region, but to me, this is an important patriotic story. It's an important revolutionary story. And I think that when you think about like sort of a legacy, I think the story of Gabriel can speak to many different people. In many different ways, and I think that it can speak to all of us as Americans about, you know, what it is to be patriotic. I mean, just for example, you know, while I was writing the book, I went to hear some of the people who participated in the Richmond 34 lunch counter sit-ins, mm-hmm. To hear them talk, and I actually strung a little piece of that dialogue and wove it into the book because it seemed important to me. It seemed like as I was listening to the Richmond 34 folks talk about that, what that meant for them as young people, right? They were students at Virginia Union. What it meant for them as students to sort of stand up and insist on equality and self-determination.
So you have their dialogue from
one little piece. I'm going to tell you that. So one of the women who was a student at the time, you know, she said the gentleman, I guess he was also a student, who was sort of leading and organizing the Richmond 34. Kind of asked them. He's asking them to dig deep, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like Gabriel was asking his men to dig deep. And so he asked the students, do you think you're too small to make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the question for everybody. If we're going to be Americans, that's the thing. Whether we're talking about pursuit of freedom, whether we're talking about being engaged in the political process, whether we're talking about, you know, helping our General Assembly understand what we want as citizens. That's the question every day at the end of the day is, well, do you think you're too small to make a difference? And in this country, the answer is, no, you're not too small. Nobody's too small. All of our voices have to be at the table and be participating in the forming of a more perfect union. That's what we got to do. So when I heard them say that, when I heard the Richmond 34 participants talking about those days when they were trying to, you know, just muster their courage and wear their best clothes and, you know, get downtown and make a stand. That was the question. So,
yeah.
So to me, I was trying to do that also with the book, is sort of create this story and this fictional character as a legacy for an awful lot that came after, and kind of standing in that tradition of art. Do you think you're too small to make a difference? And so I did take that, you know, borrow that one phrase from Richmond 34 and weave it into Gabriel's voice and Gabriel's question to the men he was recruiting. Do you think you're too small to make a difference?
So it's a timeless question that
I think it is. So I think his story is timeless for that same reason, because, you know, he had a lot going against him, and you have to figure, like, you have to interpret. I think he must have been a really positive person, a positive thinking person, because the odds are really against you. You know, I mean,
they certainly are.
Right?
I guess the world at that time must have felt a little bit smaller, right?
Yes, I mean, I guess so.
They're hearing about the rebellion in Haiti, and that's been successful. It's not Haiti then, but it becomes,
yeah, St. Dominique, right?
So they're hearing about that, and they're hearing about France,
right.
And the revolution there. And I mean, it must feel almost like this is something
that's
going to
happen.
Grab,
right.
But yeah, I mean, he must have. I mean, there's no way, even with all that going on around you, that you would not need to be truly a positive individual, somebody who really had a high understanding and opinion of your own abilities.
Right, and a very concrete, clear vision of where you wanted to be. Right.
And he almost got there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's also one of the amazing flukes of history. I mean, there's whole TV shows on the Discovery Channel or whatever that talk about how the weather changes the course of history.
Wow, yeah.
And, you know, Hannibal and, you know, all these great generals through history and how, you know, pivotal moments in their military lives and careers, you know, the fate of the world could have swung a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've got a guy who really, truly has an amazing battle plan.
Mm-hmm.
The battle plan is not unlike something that you might see a trained general come up with. He knew what he wanted. He was going to go and first set a fire, right?
Three columns were going to march into the city. I think one was going to go to the newly built but yet unopened penitentiary where there was some gunpowder and things mm-hmm. stored. They were going to go.
Which is what? Now, wait, is this the where the gallows are?
No, so the gallows are down at 15th Street, and then the city jail is around where the farmer's market is.
Mm-hmm.
But you remember the old penitentiary around Spring Street? So
right.
They built a new penitentiary there in 1800 during
Latrobe's,
the same period.
Latrobe's
right,
jail.
Right.
Okay.
And it hadn't opened yet, but there was some.
So they had gunpowder there.
They had some gunpowder there. And then the governor had distributed the arms of the militia back out to the countryside. They had been inventoried, tagged, and repaired so that the state had an understanding of where all these arms were.
Now, what I had heard was most of those arms were still in the Capitol building.
Arms and ammo in the Capitol building, but they had also started to send the arms back out to the militia, and they were depositing them at taverns and countryside taverns, you know. So there was a store of weapons at Watson's Tavern, which was near, not far from Brookfield.
Okay.
So the idea that you get from the trial documents is that they figured they didn't need to make, because Gabriel and his brother were making swords, mm-hmm. they were running bullets, and then a lot of the men had been recruited were kind of taking inventory of what weapons that they could get their hands on as well. But they knew they didn't need to have enough weapons to actually get into the city and take the city. They needed to have enough to sort of put up enough of a fight to get to the next place where there were arms.
Where the weapons were, right.
The tavern, the penitentiary. And then there was a man named Bob Cooley who had said he would leave the arsenal door open on the Capitol Square and they would rearm there. So three columns, one column going to the penitentiary.
Now, is it true that Gabriel visited the Capitol building in the days or weeks before the...
Well, that's what the documents say, that he was coming into the trial testimony says he was coming into the city every Sunday, taking inventory of what was happening.
Scoping the place out.
Right. Talking with Bob Cooley and getting this agreement to leave the door open, sort of understanding where everything was. So one column, penitentiary, one column was going to march out to Rockets, where the city was still, the hardscape was still largely wood. And they were going to set fire to that end of the city as a diversion, right, to draw mm-hmm. out any men from the city.
And this is where it really becomes a battle plan.
Who could potentially put up a fight. And then the third column would arm themselves at Watson's Tavern, proceed to the Capitol, get the weapons from the arsenal at the Capitol,
right.
And then go into the governor's mansion and take James Monroe hostage until he, you know, the idea was that he would then abolish slavery in Virginia. And at the same time, there were men gathering in Norfolk who were waiting to hear that
success.
The rebellion had gotten off the ground. Men in Petersburg waiting to hear the same thing. And I believe in Suffolk also.
So all over, this was a rebellion that was going to pop off with each moment of that happened, this happened.
Right. The canal had just opened. And so there's some mention in the sources that up into Cartersville,
mm-hmm.
or Cumberland County, the boatmen had.
And this is another area where there's some munitions up that way, right?
Or in recruiting and involving men,
okay.
Right? So that natural network, right? Formal network of the canals.
And then again, so now we have this amazing plan.
Yeah.
And it ends with a night at Brook Creek.
Yeah, so a massive storm. And they can see the storm. So they had voted the same night the men voted Gabriel to be their general. They also voted to proceed with the business. They were using two pieces of code language so they could talk about their plans openly or not have to always be, I guess, in secret. They called the plot the business, mm-hmm. and they called one another the boys. Mm-hmm. So that could say, Chris, how are the boys in Manchester, mm-hmm. whatever? And you'd say, the boys are great. They're ready to do the business. So we were just now saying, how's the recruiting going in Manchester? You're saying, good, good. I've got a lot of men. We're ready to proceed with the rebellion. And so they voted to go forward with the business mm-hmm. on August Saturday night, August the 30th. They talked about a bunch of different days. There were, one man, I think it might have been Martin, one of Gabriel's brothers, who said, if we wait too much longer, we're going to be in a winter war. Mm-hmm. And we don't really want to be in a winter war. We're not ready to be freezing and starve,
So they even recognize this, that in warfare—
We need to take advantage, yep.
There's a definite advantage not to be fighting a winter war.
Exactly. So they voted to proceed on August the 30th. And then you can sort of see, what's happened in the trial documents are like a flashback. Everyone's telling the story, from looking back and saying, yeah. So you see that on that day of August the 30th, there were two things happening. Gabriel and his brother Solomon were in the blacksmith shop continuing to make weapons, running some more bullets, making sure everything was ready. Solomon was moving up and down Brook Road, which is now Brook Road. I think it was called the Richmond Road. If now that I've said that, any historians that are actually listening will sort of correct me if I was wrong. All right, so—
That road.
They're out there kind of surveying the land and seeing how everything's going.
And they can see the storm coming?
They can see the storm coming, and they kind of convince themselves, because they don't know how massive the storm is going to be. But they say, that might actually work to our benefit. Nobody will be out, and maybe we can just sort of move into the city without a lot of notice and without a lot of fighting. And then when the storm really started to bear down upon them, they quickly realized that, the bridges were washing out. Well, you remember Gaston, which happened mm-hmm. the same exact day, August 30th, 2004.
Which is pretty amazing.
Right. So, Shaco Bottom filled up like a bathtub, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember cars floating and where we live, just on the other side
the
of the river.
Rats running out of Shaco.
Yeah, little bridges were washed out. How many people died? 14, 10, 12, 14 people.
There were people that died. I recall one mm-hmm. that was actually at Brook Road. I think it was on Lakeside, but it was at the Brook.
Right. So this is the kind of weather event that happened. Just came up and stopped and just really did cut off access to the city. And James Monroe wrote about it. You can look in other diaries of men around the region, they're writing the same things. They've never seen such a storm. So he didn't have access. And then they realized what was happening, and they planned to move the rebellion to the following night, Sunday, August the 31st. And Gabriel and Nan and his brother and Sam Bird, and maybe Jupiter, were moving quickly around the neighborhood of Brookfield, which mm-hmm. was like St. Joseph's Villa, Bryan Park, Virginia Center Commons, that's sort of more or less in that kind of area. And I'm trying to tell people not tonight, meet tomorrow night at the tobacco barn of Prosser's. Well,
where,
in the meantime.
Where was that? Do you know where the tobacco barn was?
Well, so there's if you go to the website at the Henrico Historical Society, there's an 1806 drawing. A mutual insurance drawing of Brookfield that mm-hmm. shows the house and also has two little sketches of barns that were part of Brookfield that indicate they were kind of behind the house.
Okay.
And so my general marker for where Brookfield was, where the old Celebrity Room Pizza was?
Mm-hmm.
Generally right about there. And so I don't know exactly where the tobacco barns would have been, but that was sort of the vicinity of Brookfield. It was 2,000 acres. I have a little map at home that kind of shows the whole tract of land. So anyway, they had planned to move it to the next night. Well, what they didn't know is in the meantime that two enslaved men who lived at Meadow Farm had gone to the owner of Meadow Farm Mosby Shepherd and said, those two guys had been involved in the plot, but now they turned the plot in. Why? I don't know. Were they afraid of the weather? Did the weather spook, scare them? Or did they just sort of
divine intervention
get
with the storm?
Nervous, or you don't know what their motivation was. But they turned the plot in and they turned Gabriel in. So Mosby Shepherd dispatches this letter to James Monroe saying, two men, a Pharaoh and Tom, who I, trust, came to me and said that the rising is about to occur and Prosser's Gabriel is the lead man. And then James Monroe believed him. There are also, if you look in the correspondence leading up to it, there are little indications that people were hearing about the conspiracy, but they weren't really getting any attention from James Monroe. No one was really paying attention to it.
Right. What's amazing to me is afterwards, the reverberations of this continue for a decade.
Right.
And or more, maybe even. I mean, where Gabriel's Rebellion, this thing in Virginia that probably by now legend had it, or by then legend had it, that involved thousands of people, thousands of slaves ready to rise up. And just the idea of people sort of living in fear after this. And there was a lot of fear in the colonies after Gabriel's Rebellion. He really did have this wide-ranging effect, or broad effect, on sort of how people interacted with their property during this period.
And I think there were a number of laws that were enacted
shortly
after. Really because of that, because of the rebellion, related to manumission and whether, people who were enslaved, if they were then freed, would have to leave the state after a year, that kind of thing. So they were definitely the control of the population changed. But I also think that if you look at kind of what was going on in the newspapers in Richmond and in Fredericksburg, there were people who were writing in editorially to say, well, what did you really expect? Liberty and slavery cannot coexist. So I think fear was definitely a piece of what was happening in the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
They were fear of loss of the status quo.
Property.
Mm-hmm, lives. But there were also people who kind of were understanding what was happening and sort of saying in the public discourse, well, what did we think? These two things, they don't work together.
It's amazing. It's a wonderful book, and I'm almost done with it.
Well, you know how it ends,
I
right?
do know how it ends, but it's not in what happens. It's the telling of it, and it really is an amazing telling of a story that it's been for so long lost to history, and it seems to be slowly reemerging. And you did a great job of not just digging it up, but dusting it off and just painting it beautifully. So
thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming in. Again, I'm here with, and I'm going to mispronounce her name unless I'm looking at it, so it's Gigi Amato.
Yep.
And she is the author of Come August, Come Freedom, The Bellows, The Gallows, and The Black General Gabriel, Prosser's Gabriel, who was a slave here in Richmond and led a slave revolt in 1800.
Right. Thanks a lot, Chris. This was really fun. Thank you.
Years
before,
down in Santo Domingo, slaves refused to submit, took the right of all men. Virginia whites got nervous and armed more militias as blacks inspired, plotted, and passed on their plans. Mr. Prosser's Gabriel was smart as he was strong.
And that's our show, Jive Turkeys, for November 23rd, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Shatzy, and our board op this week, Mike McKenzie. You want to share a news tip with us? Well, email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. From all of us here at WRIR's Weekly News Digest, Open Source RVA, happy Black Friday, everyone.
The bottom feels so much better than the top. So much better. Shopper, you won't pick it up.
off to bingo has become an obsession. So wary of the kids when they're wearing their hoods up. And even if they smile at you, you think it's a stick up. You only buy the paper just to cut out the coupons. You're saving 50p, but what do you want with tampons? You're always at the doctor picking up your prescription. And they throw in some KY just to ease up the friction. You got a leak in your colostomy bag. Yeah, it's got a hole in, hole in, hole in. Can you're shopping with your trolley, it's sad. How you're rolling, rolling, rolling. No shopper, taking a look, but you never buy. And you're a window shopper. You won't pick it up if it's over a fiver. Nana, you're a window shopper. Get on the bus, cause you still can't drive. Nana, you're a window shopper. Mad as a pony, just
totally going on.
Okay.